welcome to State of the Revolution. Today on State of the Revolution, we'll be talking with Jason Morgan, a Washtenaw County Commissioner from the 8th District. But first, I'm here with Leah Dotson, a IPSC community activist, and we're going to talk about the news for a minute. What do you got that you want to talk about today?
One of the first things like that I recently read about was pretty local-based, but it was a piece talking about like housing discrimination and the affordability debate that we've been talking about. So Concentrate, which is a local media source in the area, they've actually been publishing a lot about it, and it was funny because they had this article talking about, like, what are you most excited for in Washtenaw moving into 2019? And a lot of the people who, like, run the website or whatever, they talked on it, right? And the topic of affordable housing, either as, like, being excited about the movement growing or that they're hoping to see that, like, what we're kind of started with this year just flourish next year came up like 4 or 5 times. And it was really surprising to me that, like, when you're asking, like, what are you most excited for? The conversation of affordable housing came up.
Right. Well, that tells you where people are at, you know, in the state of the economy currently, is that people are concerned about whether or not they're going to have housing. And, you know, so affordable housing is exciting. What did they talk about? Do they have some, you know, what's currently going on in affordable housing?
Well, so, like, that was just kind of what caught my eye. And so I started digging a little deeper. And Concentrate released an article back on December 5th that talked about, we have this, like, new group called the Washtenaw Housing Coalition, which, to my understanding, that might not be the, like, finalized name of it, but they formed and had their first meeting on December 1st. They were, like, the event was hosted by the Huron Valley Democratic Socialist Association, and according to Concentrate's article, there were 30 different groups, like, represented in the members that attended, and Greg Pratt, who's a pretty local activist, he was really involved in a bunch of campaigns and issues. He kind of was the piloter of it, but so we're actually ending the year with now a countywide, like, committee to address this. And then it was funny to me because then on the 19th, you know, Concentrate releases this article, what are you looking forward to? And housing affordability was right there. So there's just this unison of it. So I'm pretty excited to, like, see moving into 2019, like, what this coalition can do. And I think that it's pretty interesting because obviously, this is a countywide coalition, and we're pretty diverse in what the topic is everywhere.
Right. So let's
bring everything together.
Well, yeah. So I understand there's a countywide coalition talking about affordable housing, but tell me about affordable housing.
Oh, just like what the
because how is that going to work for people? I mean, there's different ways that you can do it. What are they talking about doing?
Well, the first meeting pretty much was getting everyone together and getting ideas down. And their goal, by what I've found and talked to some of the people involved, is they're going to kind of, like, set this base of their top projects, but they don't have the list yet. Like, this was their first meeting. And that'll be what they tackle going into it. But, like, as far as, like, what's going on with, like, affordable housing, I mean, as a renter myself, like, the conversation hasn't changed that, like, all the prices just keep going up and going up. So it's, like I said, now we've seen over the past couple of years people kind of talking about it here and there. And we saw groups like Day and Ready and IPSC, so Defend Affordable IPSC for Day, start really getting much more vocal. And now we're ending the year seeing that what at one point was kind of this outlier, more radical approach, you know, oh man, the renters are angry. But as you start realizing that Ipsy City is 77% renter, you start realizing, okay, that's a big population.
Sure.
So what was just this conversation that people talked about, now we're ending the year with a full coalition to address this because we're realizing this isn't just a couple people angry. And I would argue that in our last city council race with Desiree Simmons, we saw a lot more renters have a voice not a thing we've ever seen, and it's making the county realize, okay, this is a population, like, issue, like a huge population issue.
I mean, this isn't new, that
Ipsy
is 77% renters.
No, but I think people are recognizing it now in a different way, because, like, we don't think about renters as being people who are going to be engaged in the community. I think people think of renters as, like, super transient and not invested, but the reality is most of us are renters because there's no way we're going to be able to afford a house. It's not going to happen, especially in the city, because of the tax rates.
So, what do you think is some of the solutions that they're talking about? Because, I mean, you know, for example, I mean, in some cities like New York, you have rent control departments, for example. You have different kinds of government subsidies. I had Jeff Irwin, who was just recently elected to the state senate district that covers Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. State Senate District 18, and we talked about how one of the things we talked about was that a lot of the solutions that are that are being talked about for affordable housing end up being short-term gains for affordable housing and long-term benefits to to the property owners.
Right.
And so the affordable housing stuff ends up being things like, well, for a few years, this thing will, this particular property will, you know, provide at least this many square feet of affordable housing or something mm-hmm. like that. But that will fade off over time and eventually, it'll just make more money for the property owner.
Yeah.
And that's, and the rents go up, which is how they make more money on it.
Right.
So I'm really interested in, what kind of alternative solutions people have. I mean,
yeah.
I think there's a reasonable argument to be made that says, look, if we're going to have cities, that means that we're going to have, dense population, which means that space is going to be in, short supply and high demand. In that situation, you end up having a situation very similar to the situation with healthcare, which is that you can't have an economy that works for everybody if you base certain of those basic needs like healthcare, like housing, like education
mm-hmm.
on a market model, because.
Right.
A market model only works when people can say yes or no, without, any significant, any serious push one direction or the other to this apartment or that apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But when we don't have affordable housing in the city and we don't have good public transportation, people are forced into a situation where they can't choose to live in a lower cost area. Lower cost means less dense, typically,
mm-hmm.
Because the transportation isn't
right.
there, they can't get to jobs, so they wouldn't be able to pay for that eventually anyway. And then in the city, things are so expensive that that local wages aren't enough to support that.
Yeah.
So these are, these are some things that.
Yeah. So maybe, I mean, it doesn't, like, we're not ending the year with, like, I wouldn't necessarily say it was like solutions by any means,
right.
but we're ending the year with the reality that I guess what I'm most excited about to see is this fact that we might actually have the potential to bring all these groups that have kind of created game plans or ideas together, because
sure.
I really think that a countywide approach is probably mm-hmm. going to be the better solution than like each city or township trying to figure it out. And so I would say I'm excited
right.
to see what we're moving into in 2019.
But don't ask me
how we're going to necessarily
fix that
scenario.
No. It's a difficult problem for sure. I just want to point out that, yeah, I think the county, looking at it countywide is important. Actually, I think looking at it more broadly than that as,
mm-hmm.
Regionally, because as I
yeah.
said, transportation is a big part of what drives, housing affordability issues.
Right.
It's not the only thing, obviously. There's a lot of stuff in there, but that's one of the key,
well,
one
and
of the key things.
Regionally, like,
so regional transit system.
Yeah, that's what
is
I was gonna say.
That...
There's been a lot thrown around, and I mean, I don't think there's been anything like super recent about it. About creating like a 4-county-wide transit system
yeah.
to kind of like effectively start looking at things in a regional breakdown
right.
instead of just looking at things so split off.
And you're a local Lipsy activist, and maybe you know this, but I think there's probably a lot of people that don't that. Back in the, I can't remember if it was in the 20s or 30s up to like the 40s or 50s. I can't remember the exact time span, but we used to have streetcars in Ypsilanti.
Oh, no,
yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no,
if
you could go on, you can go and look in the historical logs, you can see photos of them. People used to get on, on Cross Street, and it used to run all the way to Ann Arbor.
So
you could get a streetcar, rails in the street and,
right.
and yeah, you could get a streetcar that I think it was electric if I recall correctly.
Okay.
So they had the overhead, things that make contact to give it power, etc. But you should look that up
doing that.
No, we used to have a streetcars that went Ipsy to Ann Arbor and back. There was a whole article I read in I can't remember the name of the newspaper from way back when,
mm-hmm.
Talking about, how students from EMU are going up to Ann Arbor to hang out and stuff
right,
like that
yeah.
and coming back,
I was the one that had the car, luckily, when I was at EMU, and so I was always the driver for
sure.
everybody. It kind of blew my mind how many people didn't have a car, and obviously it's a point of privilege because I had a car for my
sure.
father,
sure.
but so something I've often done has been the driver because so many people don't
right.
have a car here
right.
and the transit system is hit or miss and
right.
I mean, I've watched my friends try to take 2-year-olds in strollers on the transit system, mm-hmm. and it's just a nightmare. So, right. like, I've always tried to help right. drive with it. Right. But I think you're right. I think that, like, you can't necessarily fully address our housing issues without addressing, like, the transit issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is such a limit in, like, job right. opportunity right. in that regard. Then.
Right. right.
But, I mean, there is some hope. I mean, there's a article, like, the most recent articles are all from the fall. Talking about, like, transit, but, like, there is an article from MLive with Dana Afana wrote it, talking about the LaBar is a gentleman who's actually been working on this, like, idea of a 4-county thing, mm-hmm. and there is hope from him that they'll have something that's workable to put on a 2019 ballot initiative.
So for affordable housing?
No, for transit.
For so transit, okay, gotcha.
A bigger answer, and where you no longer have right. to just be like, okay, if I live in Ipsy City, this is my radius of where mm-hmm. I can work.
Right.
You could have the potential of, if I live in Ipsy City and there's right. a really good job in, yeah. I think it's Oakland, McCall, and Wayne,
right.
I can get on my bus here right. in Ipsy and I can get those jobs that are out right. in that area that right, right. now is completely inaccessible
right.
to me.
Right.
And so that's like a really cool thing that we might be able to start seeing some actual progress in right. this 2019 year
right.
with the Housing Coalition and with this conversation of these combined county transits. We might actually start to see some solid foundations to start, mm-hmm. hopefully, I would say, by 2020, right. actually have some right. real solutions right. or steps forward. So right. it was right. kind of cool to see these things as I was kind of like looking, you know, what's been talked about. I came across the transit because it came up when sure. I looked about how we had renewed back right. in the primaries, you know, to continue expanding. And mm-hmm. like, if you look at the trends over time, like that's just been super heavily supported. And mm-hmm. I, like you said, I think that that'll feed into hopefully some of this initiative we can see with the Housing Coalition.
Yeah, that's great. There's 30 different groups coming together and talking
yeah.
about that. I mean, that's good. We need more of that kind of interconnection. Because I mean, one of the things that makes it hard to get things done is so many different groups doing their own mm-hmm. little thing
yeah,
and not
exactly.
coordinating and networking to apply their, combined power and energy. That's a really, that's a really important thing. I just want to emphasize this, having the transit and affordable housing, I think, as something that we look at together.
Yeah, it's a two-play approach in that regards.
Right, right. I mean, there's other things that you have to put into that, too. I mean, we have problems with food deserts and so, you know, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah, I mean, Ipsy is still definitionally a food desert by the USDA because the
right.
only food sources within it outside of your party stores is Ipsy Food Co-op, which is economically a bit a struggle for a 1-in-3-person poverty rate city.
Right.
And then you have Dos Hermanos, which is a really mm-hmm. great like Hispanic market, but mm-hmm. it's considered a specialty market because of that. So
right.
you still do have that issue. And before we
right.
had the transit expansion that we saw a few years ago,
right.
if you wanted to go up, I think it was up Hamilton and Whitaker to get to the like Kroger's,
yeah.
the bus line stopped and
right.
you had to walk the rest
of the way.
And there aren't sidewalks on a lot
right.
of that road there either. And that's a
right.
very busy road with a lot of different intersections.
Yeah.
So previous to that expansion, if you were stuck in Ipsy City Food Desert
and
you had a kid and you were going to go up there,
yeah.
like you had a hard walk ahead of you. So you're right. I don't think you can separate out like our need for transit and our need for affordability and housing, because I think if you expand better transit, you expand the job market, which helps a lot with this idea of, you know, income accessibility.
Right.
So.
Right.
But yeah, so some cool things to see in like some local news sources that I see a lot of stuff kind of tying together.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does feel good to see 2018, which was a pretty well successful year for us as far as like politics go, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the state, to be ending with some coalition building and
right.
Kind of a more solidified
right.
foundation moving forward. I hope.
Right. On the other hand, we're also ending with the lame duck.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, if
finally...
you really want to talk about news, lame duck was the other thing in my mind. I mean, I was Representative Robbie. You said Robbie is one of my
yeah.
friends on Facebook, and like
sure.
I saw his statuses this morning where he's like 21 hours straight or something
right.
like that, and I was just like blown away that lame duck lasted. And then you read all the bills that came out, and
mm-hmm.
You know, I was a field director for Dana Nessel's campaign for
right.
Michigan Attorney General, and
sure.
I read that lame duck bill that came out, pretty much just like. Creating, I've heard it referred as a shadow attorney general spot,
right.
and like, obviously, I'm biased to that campaign, but like that hit home, like just realizing, you know, like we have this woman who's going to be a fighter, and they're so scared of her that they just went and
yeah.
did the same thing to Secretary of State, to our governor.
Yeah.
See, I mean,
well,
on one hand, I'm glad we have some really strong
sure.
women who are willing to go and to fight, but at the other hand, you sit here staring at these bills that just got passed. Like, are you kidding me?
Right. Well, so the thing is, here's a point that I want to make about that just really that just really it 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 boggles my mind that people don't make this connection more often. What's happening in the lame duck here right now is that we have a group of legislators who are the majority in in both houses of the legislature, but do not have the support of a majority of the people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, look at that bill specifically. The people voted for these women and as well as others, you know, and their response was, let's ignore our state.
Mm-hmm. And my point is that the issue is that you have a majority of the legislature elected by a minority of the citizens.
Yeah.
Okay. That's how it always is in the U.S. Senate. 17% of the 17% of the population of the country elect 52 senators. Okay. So that's the permanent state of the U.S. Senate in the current configuration. And yes, in Michigan, we passed Prop 2 to redistricting. So we have nonpartisan redistricting.
That
was
not touched by lame duck. I actually read a report today that they were, you know, saying,
right.
Silver lining moments.
Right. No, the thing is that the people that put Prop 2 together did it in a very smart way, which is that they made it a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. And the constitutional amendment specifically says the legislature cannot can't touch this these provisions, so even if they had done it, I mean I'm sure that there were some of them that just wanted to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. But even if they had done it, it would have been a pretty pretty slam dunk thing in the courts.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward. So on the other hand, they've been stacking the courts a lot.
Exactly. So we may see in Michigan that dynamic change, but. Like U.S. Senate-wise, that's always going
to
exist.
Then. Well, yeah, no, because we can change that too. It's just a lot more work.
Right, exactly.
But what I'm saying is that when we're talking about all these terrible things that they did in the lame duck that we hate, we have had majority support for universal health care in this country for a long time.
Correct.
Okay, we've had majority support for improve our voting system so that more people can more easily vote.
Yeah, definitely.
We've had majority support for taking care of veterans, for example. All kinds of different things we've had support for: infrastructure, renewable energy. All of this stuff, and all of the reasons that it's not happening at the federal level is because of the Senate being a permanent gerrymander. That's a big part of the reason that doesn't happen. We get all upset about what's happening in the Michigan legislature, which absolutely, it's a terrible stuff. Same thing's happening in Wisconsin, by the way. They did similar stuff in North Carolina. Florida, the Republicans in Florida are trying to walk back the citizens' initiative that was passed by overwhelming majority
to
reinstate voting rights.
This isn't just a Michigan scenario. I'd argue Michigan was insane, but you're right. This is a dynamic that we're seeing GOP do in multiple states.
Right.
But you're right. I think a lot of people who were in Lansing this week, they probably don't recognize that this scenario is what's happening in the U.S. Senate. I don't think they recognize that that's gerrymandering.
It's been happening for 242 years in the U.S.
I don't think
US
people
Senate.
Recognize that as gerrymandering. I think it's easier to look at your congressional map and go, like, clearly this is messed up.
Well, because that changes all the time.
Exactly. Right. But, like, you know, you think about, okay, the same scenario is happening in the U.S. Senate. I don't necessarily think about that, give or take. It's frustrating, and it's also crazy then, because, you know, we've seen now what happens in this kind of structure, and it makes you start thinking about what you just said, is like, well, if we had majority support, this is what's happening up there too. I'd like to educate that and build on that after this lame duck. I know everyone's kind of like exhausted and needs to reset themselves, especially like our representatives who've been fighting, but I think what you just said is something I don't think most people know. And I think that that gives us a, like, springboard education off of lame duck to be like, okay, this is clearly a bad system in the States, but also this is clearly a bad system that we still have in D.C. Right.
Anytime that we have a legislative body that's elected by less than a majority of the population, we're going to have this kind of problem, because that minority of the population, first of all, it's easier for special interests to control a smaller number of people, or to influence them, in particular ways, through propaganda and media and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so that's always going to be a problem. The other side of that is that we also have to make sure that we have, representation of, groups in the minority, whether that is, you know, whether that is, racial or ethnic minorities, or whether that's, you know, even ideological minorities. I mean, I'm, you know, I believe in separation of church and state, and very, very strictly. But I also think that people who are religious deserve to have representation, you know, whether they're in the majority or in the minority or any particular.
But that option of representation still has to be there.
Right. So there, we have a system that was designed, you know, almost 250 years ago, for a society that thought very differently about who is, who needs to have a voice and how we're going to support those people having a voice and what things are important to protect. And what things ought to be valued in what order.
Right.
Those things have changed over the past 250 years.
So then you can make the argument that maybe we need to start changing how representation is done in the Senate.
Absolutely. I think that's a really core point that we need to take away from what's happening in the state legislatures, because we talk about the states being experiments, you know, democracy experiments.
Right.
You know, well, we should take this as a democracy experiment and look at what happens when you have legislative bodies that are that only have minority support among the population, and recognize that, you know, in terms of the Senate, that's what we do. Gerrymandering in the House, that's what we do. And also that's what we do in the Electoral College.
Yeah,
Michigan is underrepresented in the Electoral College by 219%.
Yeah. I think it's really crazy for people to take away and realize that what we just saw in lame duck is what we're seeing in the Senate, and it's also what we see in the Electoral College. There was so much upset about that in this past presidential election, and it's going to be a debate in the next one.
Right.
But the fact that that's all actually a version of, like, gerrymandering?
Yes.
I don't think that connection is made.
Yeah.
And I think that, like I said, like, springboard that off of this, but so then my question and my challenge then to a lot of Democrats would be, find a way to educate on that.
Mm-hmm.
Find a way to, yes, we're walking away from lame duck, pretty aggravated and pretty annoyed, and a lot of us probably pretty disheartened because we worked our butts off for this.
Right.
But find a way to educate on this is more reform that we have to do at all these different levels and explain the differences.
Right.
But I think that would be my challenge then, is find some way to be productive from this craziness.
Right. Right. So recognize that what we're all upset about lame duck is what happens at the federal level every single year.
Yeah. Yeah,
all the time,
definitely.
Not during the lame duck, during the regular session, because, you know, a minority of the population elects a majority of the Senate. We've gone over that a number of times. It irks me so much that it just comes out a lot.
I think it's a fair point to drive you crazy. And like I said, I think it's a fair point because most people aren't even, like, concerned about it or addressing it, and the reality is you know, it's going to continue then.
Sure. So one of the other things I wanted to talk about is I read this article on it's on Truthout actually right now about the fight for single payer healthcare in New York.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things that they're reporting on is that there's a split between most Democratic and liberal activists, progressive activists in New York, and unions there, where you have a number of unions, particularly the, I'm looking for right now, I think it was the firefighters, union. Hold on a second. Let me just make sure I get it right. Says New York City Municipal Unions, part of an umbrella group called the New York City Municipal Labor Committee, have serious qualms about the bill currently working through. Mm-hmm. Together, they represent about 380,000 public employees. So they have some concerns about it, but more conservative unions, New York State Building and Construction Trades Council and the Uniformed Firefighters Association of Greater New York are outright opposing the proposal, it says here. Hmm. These unions have joined a new initiative called Realities of Single Payer, quote unquote, backed by a coalition of healthcare industries and business groups, that are seeking to kill the legislation. So,
surprised that it's healthcare industries and business groups.
Shocker,
right?
Well, but you know, well, it is. But you'd think, I mean, you know, there's so much evidence that shows that if we had universal single payer, that it would be good for businesses because they wouldn't be constantly at the negotiating table over that issue. It would be taken care of. But what this article is pointing out is that. This is one of the places where unions actually have fights with, you know, and where they can show value to their members.
Mm-hmm. Here's the power of being part of the union. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Exactly. And so, a lot of the right to work stuff that's gone on and a lot of the ways that corporatist conservatives who, you know, want to kill unions have gone about changing the incentive structures of our legal system as it relates to unions and labor law. The Janus decision, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is that there are some unions that apparently feel they have an incentive to not back that because that takes away something that they can, a service that they can deliver to their members. And, I'm sure when we talk to Jason in a little bit about, Washtenaw County, I'm sure we'll talk about, the Nexus Pipeline, for example, and how there's also been conflict, with the progressives and unions over that.
Mm-hmm. And the labor movement is a really big debate there, I think.
Sure.
The unions, there is conflict there. There's in this kind of conversation, and who has the power, and what can I offer?
I think that's an issue that we really have to address because, you know, from my perspective, Black people, LGBTQ folks, unions, all of these groups need to be at the forefront of the progressive movement. I mean, that's the way that I see it. But that also means that we have to be looking far enough ahead to make big changes so that we can have a future that we're not preparing for right now because we're not addressing climate change and moving away from pipelines, for example, hurts pipe fitters. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, we need to figure out ways to, and the other problem is that we want to do, you know, renewable energy rather than the pipelines, for example, but then we have so many incentives built into the system for 19th century energy sources.
Right. It's hard to change that mentality.
That's hard.
It's a workforce any change is scary. Okay. No one likes change, but it is a workforce that you can replace, you know, fossil fuel industries with renewable. Does it happen overnight? No, but do we have to start a process and a planning and a plan for that? Sure, of course we have to. Change is scary, but change doesn't mean imminent danger or nothing goes back. If anything, change actually means the population's going to be more safer than they currently are.
Well, yeah. And if the way that we implement change is by looking at what the community needs, not what individual businesses or large conglomerates need.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talk about the healthcare industry and everything. What's good for them isn't always good for the community. What's good for a pipeline company isn't good for the community, vice versa. And there's so many more examples of that. But I think your argument of making sure that a lot of these groups are at the forefront to be able to push this forward is important because that brings, and I always use the analogy of the table. And unfortunately, you're going to have to sit at the table with some pretty nasty corporations, but you have to sit at the table to some degree to fix this. And I think we really need to continue to encourage the union groups and the labor forces, we're not going to leave you out there hanging. That's not our game plan here.
Right. No, we absolutely need to make sure that everybody has, a decent job, decent wages, good benefits, healthcare, and so mm-hmm. on, affordable housing. We were talking about a little,
All of that ultimately ties together. Right. Like, all of that.
That's right. And it's all about what kind of a system do we have mm-hmm. for as a community. Creating, taking resources and transforming them into what we need to live. And how do we organize our system for doing that in a way that takes care of mm-hmm. the whole community?
Yeah.
Not just concentrates wealth in the hands of a few.
Definitely. And when there are places that we can't look at, like, what system do we have? I think then we have to ask the question of what system do we need? And I feel like that's probably something that we'll be able to talk more with Jason about as far as our county goes, is what system do we need to be able to tackle and approach these types of conversations.
Absolutely. I know that these conversations that progressives and union folks, and there are lots of progressives in the unions, mm-hmm. That's not a dichotomy, that's just... there are progressive union folks that are pushing their unions, to support universal healthcare. And I think that's great. And we need to have more conversations with more conservative folks in the unions. Or people that even aren't necessarily conservative, just saying, hey, we need a job and this is the job that's on offer. Mm-hmm. We need to have a way of being able to sit down at that table with these corporations and actually have a bargaining position that says, yeah, okay, if we don't build the pipeline, then these people are still going to have jobs.
Right.
You know, we're not dependent on the corporation to ensure that that people have the means of a decent livelihood.
Well, and taking people out of the, like, lifestyle of being dependent upon a corporation, I think could be good for them too, you know. A lot of corporations aren't actually, like, interested, obviously, in the people themselves. They're interested in their dollar bills and gain profit. And, you know, a community approach is more people-central focused, I think.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, have you had any conversations in this area where, in your organizing with people who are saying, hey, we need the job?
Yeah, I mean, those were definitely conversations that happened. A lot of union conversations you'd have with people, especially when it comes to, like, the campaign world, especially when it comes to working for Attorney General elect, like, Line 5 was her big issue.
Sure.
And I think for a little while, like, you have to ensure that, you know, we're not going to leave you hanging. And that's kind of ultimately a lot of conversations that I know that happen between unions is, like, yes, like, we don't want these pipelines, but look, like, we recognize these are your jobs. And so there was a lot of reassuring them of, hey, we're not just coming in and going to fire you all at one time, but mm-hmm. getting them to start recognizing there are other job alternatives that utilize that skill set mm-hmm. or something. Friends of mine have toyed mm-hmm. around with the idea of is creating this, like, even if it's like a nonprofit that actually takes maybe people whose skill set was pipeline fitting, and mm-hmm. a nonprofit could take that skill set, fill in that gap, and have them ready and prepared for a renewable job. Mm-hmm. But I can't say any of that until we actually have on paper a game plan of moving forward. This is our game. This mm-hmm. is what we're offering you. This is the resources we're giving you mm-hmm. to make sure that we move off of your skills mm-hmm. and maybe give you that gap you might have.
Right.
And then here's the factory that's going in, and here are the jobs, and, mm-hmm. and then have the right. unions come in and help us right. get the benefits and all that.
Right.
But right now, there's not a lot of solidified conversation, right. but that reassurance and that, like, we're trying to meet with you and work mm-hmm. with you has been something that I saw a right. lot happening right. in the last campaigns.
And that's actually, if you look at the Green New Deal that the Sunrise Movement has been pushing, and that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got behind.
Mm-hmm. And Rashida Tlaib has also gotten behind right. One of our congresswomen here in right. the state.
Right, right. I'm hoping that that more of our congresspeople will get behind it. I just read, I think it was yesterday, that they are doing some kind of a committee, but they're not giving the committee the mandate.
It wasn't fully in the way that the
Sunrise Movement proposed,
mm-hmm.
and there's still some discussion about whether or not people on that committee can have taken money from fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation still about, like, what are going to be the parameters of being part of that committee that I don't think has been, like, fleshed out well. And there's a lot of groups like Sunrise and, you know, just volunteers in the community that are still going up to their Congress representatives and asking them to sign on. Like, there is work to be done there. But what that deal offers is it addresses, I think, some of this issue that we've seen of, you know, that fear for your labor workers and your union people of, well, what happens to us, which was a very, very common. I mean, like I said, if you're going in there angry against a lot of environmental things, which, like, we were hard on, and I am hard on those, and a lot of times I think that that can scare them, but her deal shows, okay, we realize that's an issue.
Right.
I'm going to address that issue.
Right. Well,
which I think will be something that's really better to bring that deal to the table with those people, because she's recognized that and we're not pushing them aside, and it gives them their place, and it gives them, like, the recognition of what they do.
Sure. Well, that's why I was really, I haven't seen all of the details of it, but the idea that they're not going to have that mandate, and the thing about that mandate is that it was a comprehensive way of looking at this issue, so that you don't have to have the situation where unions are looking at it and the owners of the corporations that they're working for are saying, well, if you do that, then, you know, we're just gonna, you know, you're not gonna have a job.
Right.
And, you know, we have to have a comprehensive plan where it says there's gonna be an awful lot of jobs created by any plan that's gonna transition us from fossil fuels to renewables.
Mm-hmm.
And by putting that together into the same package,
I think that's
the way that you start having a bargaining position with these corporations and saying, you know, no, you're not the solution. You're not the only solution to ensuring people have a decent living.
Yeah.
And in fact, you haven't proven to be a particularly good solution, because we keep having these continual crises where you know, where not enough people have jobs and we have recessions and all of that.
And a lot of those jobs are usually temporary. I'm pretty sure that the job up north, that one of the bills that passed, and I don't remember which one it was, I think I heard it was like it saved like 40 jobs or something like that, temporary jobs.
Right.
So, like, it's not actually you could argue that it's really not any form of long-term employment. And, you know, looking at Alexandria's deal, like, or the new deal that Alexandria's are pioneering, like, it actually creates more of this longevity of employment that I think it's important that we also tell people, like, let's not necessarily look at right here and right now, which is hard to do, especially as the American culture is instant gratification and convenience. And so a lot of this focus is, well, we need these 40 jobs, but the reality is those are 40 temporary jobs.
Right.
Temporary. And if we have an alternative that could bring, let's say, 100 longevity jobs, I'm going to go with 100 jobs versus 40 jobs for longevity versus temporary.
And the issue is that we have a gap between where we are now and being able to offer those long-term jobs.
Exactly.
And the whole idea.
In that weird gap place where we've got to get this down, we've got to recognize it. But like I said, change is scary, and there's a lot of, like, those people that don't want to necessarily look at it, because that's a fearful thing to realize, like, my income, my livelihood of my family's provider, right, could disappear. But also, the Green New Deal makes it very clear we have 12 years.
Yeah.
So as much as I do not want to say, like, okay, don't worry about your current scenario, because let's be real, I'm going to worry about putting food on the table.
Sure.
We also have to let people know, like, yeah, we know where you are right now, but in 12 years, we've got this really scary scenario.
Right.
So we have to.
Well, let's be clear. The scary scenario is right now.
Yeah. Yes.
You know?
We're in the crunch time of, okay, are we going to fix something, or are we not going to fix something?
Right. And this is the thing that's really disappointing about the Green New Deal situation in this federal legislature right now, is that all that's really saying is, let's be clear about what a plan would look like.
This isn't even our answer yet. Like, this isn't a, okay, let's implement this now, boom, we're good, we've got the renewable. No, this is a, hey, here's the plan.
Well, but let me back up, because there's an important piece of this. Having that mandate that the Sunrise Movement first put in, that saying these are the components that a plan is going to have.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're going to have to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And if by not putting that as a key cornerstone of this committee in the legislature, what they're saying is that we're going to let fossil fuel companies and their lobbyists and their and their shareholders, all of whom have lots of influence over politicians, we're going to let them say, no, we have to make, you know, we have to make money off of whatever you do. Right. It's not about transitioning to a carbon neutral mm-hmm. or carbon negative economy. It's about, well, only if we get to make a cut off of that. Right. And that's going to end up meaning that the people who have trillions of dollars on their books that is actually, that represents carbon fuel in the ground, they're going to be in there going, well, we want to actually make our money. Or they may want a payoff.
Right.
You know, and I, you know, and I don't think that we should give it to them. You know, I think the fact of the matter is that,
you know, I'm not a fan of any fossil fuel right. companies. I'm not trying to hand out right. scenarios right. to them.
But the point is that the Green New Deal lays out what are the components of right. the, what the components of the plan have to be. And when you're not even, when you're going to not put that into the mandate of
how you're going to put it.
Yeah, you've taken away the bargaining power of the coalition that wants this, and you've given it away mm-hmm. to the fossil fuel industry and their ancillaries, and that's what's really disappointing about
where we're at
with Pelosi's leadership. I mean, I was actually originally very concerned that Pelosi wasn't going to be able to stand up to Trump in public in the way that needs to happen. And so far she's done much better than I expected. So full credit to her for all of that.
Yeah.
But this thing where we're not going to have a way of putting a plan together, to address this problem without the people that are causing the problem being in there to try to muck it up. That just tells me that she's not serious about this.
And I mean, it's not like we've been ignoring her and not trying to reach out to her. Sunrise right. has been adamantly there. They did a yeah. huge thing for it a couple of weeks ago.
Sure.
There were multiple, civil arrests that happened and bringing news to the fact that, hey, you know, Nancy, we're sitting here in your office and we need you to do this.
Yeah.
And, I think you're right that, like, it does say something to the fact that we're not yet at a point where we can have that. Like leadership stand up and say, okay, let's right. implement this.
Right.
And I don't know. Fingers crossed, we can see yeah. things moving better and forward. I don't see the Sunrise or the people who are involved in this, and myself included. I don't see them letting up. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that their shirts say 12 years, I think that will actually be a really impactful thing in some mm-hmm. regard, because I think people that might not necessarily really have been engaged or really care that much, when they start realizing like that's what the time crunch is, mm-hmm. that actually is scary.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've got to get people to realize what that time crunch means. I mean, yeah. there's a lot of information out there, but we need to get people to really pay attention about it and think about what it's going to mean for their lives, for their ability, for the food system, for what,
yeah.
you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah. So,
lots going on.
Lots of stuff going on. And now we're talking about on the big level, but we're actually going to go right now and bring Jason Morgan into the conversation and talk about some local county stuff that's going on.
And see how some of this is tying into our county here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we're here with Jason Morgan, Washtenaw County Commissioner from the 8th District of the county, and we're going to talk about county government and how that's important in our lives and what it does, because I think a lot of people don't really know that exactly. So let's start off with that, Jason. Talk a little bit about, first of all, a little bit about your background, how you came into government, and then let's talk about, you know, county government and what that does for people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with who I am. So I sure. ran for the County Commission 2 years ago. I'm very honored to have just recently been reelected for another 2 years. Mm-hmm. I moved to Washtenaw County 8 years ago to work for Congressman John Dingell as mm-hmm. his field representative for Washtenaw County.
Okay.
As I jumped into that role, my job was to know everything and anything about Washtenaw County, the people here, the community leaders, the issues that we're dealing with, and essentially how he could help. And so I jumped into this really exciting role of just always walking around asking everybody, how can we help you? Because that was what John Dingell did. He said, how can I help? At mm-hmm. the end of every single meeting, at the beginning of every meeting, and that was my mission. And through that role over a couple of years, I just fell in love with this community, with this place, the people here. Mm-hmm. It's something unique and special that I don't think anywhere else has. Mm-hmm. So I worked for Washtenaw Community College for 3.5 years after that as the Director of Government and Community Relations.
Okay.
And then worked for Congresswoman Dingell as her district director for a short bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then finished grad school over the last couple of years to get my master's from the University of Michigan Ford School. As of today, I am done with school.
Okay.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So it's been a long week, but an exciting day.
Sure. I know a lot of people actually, you know, just graduating, which is really great. Is it a master's degree that you just got?
Yep, in public administration.
Public administration. Okay, cool.
So now I have a piece of paper that tells me I can do government things.
Right. That you've already been doing for a while.
Right, exactly.
She's been doing.
So that's where I am. That's the sort of timeline of where I am. Right. But what got me involved and interested in politics and government, really not the politics, I hate that part some days, but the government part is really what I got into this for, is that, when I was younger, I was diagnosed with something called Becker's muscular dystrophy.
Mm-hmm.
So the neuromuscular disease, impacts your arms, your legs.
Sure.
Ultimately your heart, all of your major muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And my diagnosis wasn't real great. Essentially, I was told you'll lose your ability to walk sometime in your mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
And still, even if you look online, the life expectancy for what I have is only 42 years old. Because despite how physically active people occasionally stay,
mm-hmm.
it still impacts everything else.
Sure.
So to me, that was, it's sort of a weird way to end up trying to work in government. But for me, it sort of helped over time to give me this realization that I want to do something meaningful and purposeful with life.
Sure.
And help people. And sure. make every minute count and matter and just be a voice for people who don't always have that.
Right.
So that's sort of what grounds me mm-hmm. every day in terms of what I do in government. When mm-hmm. you have to deal with the politics and the drama of government
sure.
and, you know, just the divisiveness of it, the thing that grounds me is that and that mission of trying to help people. So that's what brought me here and has kept me here. In particular, county government.
Right.
I think is extremely exciting because it's a really exciting part of government because it's all about people.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at city councils, they deal with zoning and development and whether we're going to build mm-hmm. a building here or a parking lot or a park, you know, all those things, the sort of core services which are good.
Mm-hmm.
County government is about human services. It's about people. It's about providing a social safety net for the community.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that we oversee are the sheriff's office, the courts, the community mental health system, public health, some of the roads outside of the city of Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about people, though.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about how we take care of people, how we make sure that they're resources and services available for those who need it.
Right.
Which is why I love county government because I feel like all of the debates and the discussions are really about how do we do something better? How do we find more resources to help more people?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do we make things just work better or provide increased access for things?
So in terms of like how county government fits into, you know, our whole system of government. I mean, I think that people have, like you were saying, they have a pretty clear idea, you know, city government does like ordinances and code enforcement and they, you know, come after you when you don't mow your lawn and,
right.
And make sure that, you know, that the streets are clean and that trash gets picked up and that kind of stuff. And then on the other far end of it, you have like the federal government that does all kinds of big, gigantic programs that often then are sometimes administered by the states. But actually, as I understand it, then there's a lot of that that actually gets devolved to county government to administer on the behalf of the state or on behalf of the federal government, depending how the program's set up.
Yeah.
So can you give me some examples of some programs that work that way, that some programs that people might know about on the federal level that actually get administered by the counties?
Yeah, so one, actually a huge issue that we're dealing with right now is the community mental health system.
Mm-hmm.
We oversee the Office of Community Mental Health, and right now we're facing a $10 million deficit in that system for next year because of decisions made at the state level to not provide enough funding for the services that are provided through those services. Basically, they don't reimburse us enough to actually help people in the way that we need to help them.
Is this one of these unfunded mandates that we used to hear a lot about? That you have a mandate to provide these services, but you're not given sufficient funds to do that? Or is that not related there?
I would say it's an underfunded mandate. Okay. So they provide $88 million dollars, each year for those services. So mental health is like, you know, treating people who have disabilities or mental health challenges and caseworkers, all, you know, nurses, all that stuff that sort of involved that system of caring for people. But the state reimburses at a rate that's significantly lower than it actually costs. So one very tangible example is for home health services. Somebody, a caseworker, has to go to somebody's home to help take care of them. The state will reimburse you for the time you're with that person.
Right.
But they say that the time driving to their house does not count.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also won't let us subsidize that with our county dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if we were to say, we as a county have a value set that says we want to provide more resources for these services, they actually say you are not allowed to do that. The money we give you should be enough. But how do you pay somebody a living wage when they don't get paid for the half an hour of driving to somebody's house, but only for the half an hour or an hour of being there?
Right.
You basically divide that wage. You kind of cut it in half almost.
Right.
So it's a state problem through underfunding that we now have to figure out how to deal with at the local level.
Okay. And so what are some of your strategies for dealing with that? Is it just the fact of, well, there's only so much money, and so we have to not provide those services to as many people, or not provide as many services to the same number of people, or are there other things that you try to do to mitigate that?
Well, those are the options we're reviewing. Unfortunately, some of the options are basically decide not to provide as high of a level of services, cut people off of the system, which I don't think it would be a good choice, or you reduce salaries of our employees. So we would say, you know, for our mental health employees who are funded through the system, we'd say even though the rest of our county employees got a 2% and they're getting another 2% pay increase, those of you who work in this particular department wouldn't get that same cost of living increase.
Right.
Or what we're probably going with is suing the state to say, listen, you're requiring these services, and you're just not funding them at the appropriate level.
Right, so it is a mandate.
A mandate of a basic level of services.
Right.
That
they haven't provided the funds to pay for.
Right.
Okay.
And so that's where sort of, those are a few of the initial options, but what we're also going to be looking at is basically an entire review of our system, looking at what other counties do and figuring out how they've helped manage it in their areas. Part of the big challenge we have here in Washington County is we have a value set that says we provide a higher level of fringe benefits, so better health insurance and retirement. Sure. And so our cost for those things is quite a bit higher than other parts of the state. But we don't exactly plan to cut those things.
Right.
And so we have to find a creative way to solve our problem other than the state just saying, well, no, you just got to treat people less well.
You'd probably be in a hard spot too, to kind of decide what are the things you have to prioritize then, because especially when it comes to mental health, a lot of that is very interconnected. And if you kind of drop the value of one of those, it may impact the impact of another service. So, like, you're in a really weird spot there.
Well, we have a higher cost of living here in Washington County than you do in Monroe or Livingston County, who are other counties that are in our same area.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot more people to treat.
Mm-hmm.
So our service levels are significantly higher. So when there's a deficit and it's spread between this region, we're taking on 56% of that debt burden in a 4-county region, as Washington County. And
is that largely due to just different populations? As I recall, Washington County is about 367,000 people. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And I don't know, but the surrounding counties, I don't have that number off the top of my head. Do you know?
They're smaller. So we're the sixth largest county in the state. So we have a larger proportion of people in that system. So it's not unreasonable that we're taking on 56%. It's just a reality that we have to deal with in terms of trying to address that funding gap.
Right. So what are some of the other big projects that you're working on? That's a big one. You're taking on the state in a lawsuit, and it'll be different now with different people at the top of the state.
Right.
But with the legislature still the way it is, it's still going to be a challenge. What are some of the other challenges that you see in the works for Washington County?
So that, I would say, is probably going to be our biggest challenge. I think we have a lot more opportunities going into the next couple of years at the board. We're in a transition period right now where 4 or 9 commissioners will be brand new starting in January. So that's 44% of our board is completely new. And they're all really great people. Right.
And, this is actually the first time that it's all Democrats.
It's the first time as a 100% Democratic board. It is the first time in history that it is a majority female board.
Oh, cool.
And so it's one of the largest turnovers the board has ever had. In terms of commissioners turning over all at the same time, which some people I think are a little concerned about. I'm thrilled about it because I think we've needed change. We've needed significant change in Washtenaw County for quite a while. So my hope with these new commissioners is going to be that we sort of take on some of these questions, these big challenges that we've had that perhaps other boards haven't been willing to dive into. And then we think a little bigger than just saying, okay, are we going to respond to the proposals that are sent to us by administrative staff or the challenges that are thrown at us by the state or federal government with funding? Or are we going to try and create a vision for our county that builds a more progressive Washtenaw County and builds on the neighborhoods that we have and the communities we have to figure out how can we do something bigger with our resources and address the root causes of some of the problems that we have right now, rather than just addressing the symptoms of them?
Sure. Can you give us some examples of what you're thinking about?
Yeah. So we have not done a master plan for the county since 2004.
Oh.
The 2004 master plan is 196 pages, I believe, and I've spent a lot of time reading through it. And it was a whole different county back then. So before the recession, the auto industry was significantly more of a factor.
Yeah.
Auto industry. Okay.
The auto industry, the economy was very different. But also the prioritization for public transportation and the public infrastructure was different.
Right.
The value of natural beauty roads is listed as a higher objective than public transportation in that 2004 plan. People have obviously not stuck to that plan since 2004. Sure. They've done new things since. But to me, that says a lot about how the county was looking back then.
Right.
And the fact that we haven't done one since 2004 means we have not had a clear vision for this county of where we're going in decades. So if you look at, if you were to think about what is the vision for the county, I don't know that anybody could actually give you one.
Okay.
This county has a pretty transient population too. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy to me to hear, like I said, I was 10 in 2004. I was going into fourth grade. I will be 24 in March. So, like, that's crazy to me that we haven't done that, because we do have really transient populations with our colleges, because we have several, both community size as well as, you know, U of M, EMU, and to not have adjusted that plan since then with such a high turnover of population seems really just, I'm surprised that hasn't been addressed earlier, I guess I would say.
Well, we used to have a planning and environmental department at the county, and we eliminated both of them during the recession. They had to cut tens of millions of dollars during the recession.
Right.
And so they just cut every possible thing they could. But what it meant is that they were just sort of in a like crisis mode. They did it for a good reason, actually. The reason that they did that is because they prioritized services and maintaining staff rather than at the expense of investing in infrastructure and planning and some of these things. They basically said, we're going to cut everything we can that's not a human like life and human person, so we can maintain that part of the county, which was really, I think, a good effort and a noble effort. But now that we're coming out of that, and now that we've sort of seen such significant changes, we have to be creating a vision.
Right.
So that's my big hope for the next 2 years, is that we're going to start a master planning process, and we're going to try and find a master planning process looking at other places like King County and I think the county around L.A. That we've looked at that do things in a bit of a more community engagement type way. So not just some consultant coming in and saying, here's what you do, but finding some people who've done this before who say, here's how you engage the community and develop a master plan that's sort of thinking about public health and health equity and sort of a neighborhood level so that you're not just creating a document that isn't going to be useful.
Sure.
Well, and I think in Washtenaw County, we have so many active community groups, you know, like a lot of nonprofits, also a lot of like political groups, like to kind of just have a consultant and not have that like community leaders brought to the discussion, I think would be like a gross misjustice to Washtenaw just because of the uniqueness of our county being a relatively engaged county with pretty engaged and opinionated people, I'd say.
Yeah.
That approach to me as someone who falls under that category of like a local activist involved in a lot of groups, you know, if you give them the table, you'll hear a lot more of the reality of the neighborhoods instead of necessarily the cookie cutter version that we might see as just numbers or stats, but you'll hear the stories and stuff.
Right. Somebody can be an expert on urban planning, but that doesn't mean they're an expert on understanding how our community works. Mm-hmm. And so you have to sort of meld those two things together to say, how do we do that? And how do we do that with everybody's input and a completely open and transparent and engaged process? Because the idea with a master plan is that you will implement it.
Sure.
Right.
So you need...
Ideally, right?
Right. So ideally. So it's not just, you know, here's what you should do, but here's how we're going to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's actually, you know, there's a lot of different ways in which our system of government seems to drive short-term thinking rather than long-term planning. And we see that, I mean, right now there's been a huge national discussion about the Green New Deal, for example. Right. And one of my points about that is that what the Green New Deal is just basically an agreement to put together a team to make a plan.
Right.
And if you're not willing to put together a team to make a plan, what you're saying is you're not planning on solving the problem.
Right. Yeah.
You're planning on letting the problem do whatever it does and sort of, you know, snipe at it from, you know, different pieces, snipe at different pieces of it maybe, but you're not really addressing the problem. Mm-hmm. You're reacting to the problem.
Well, that's so, what you said, where you don't want to address the symptoms anymore, but you're hoping to actually look at a lot of the root causes. And I think a lot of times we get distracted by the symptoms because that might be what we see the most often. And I do think there's like some education gap in understanding the symptom is caused by this. And, you know, addressing that actually lets us have a game plan to fix that so we don't just have more symptoms that we're adding on over the next 10, 20 years.
Well, I'm thinking of it intersectionally where it's not just, you know, oh, we need to improve public health, let's put more money into public health. Or mm-hmm. We want to reduce crime, so let's put money into the sheriff's office. It's mm-hmm. no, it's how, if we want to reduce crime, we have to start trying to reduce poverty and addressing mm-hmm. mental health challenges and building communities and building these sort of connections with the social safety net system.
Right.
So you're not just doing these one-off little things here and there, and you're not just, you know, punishing people for committing a crime, but getting to understand why did you commit that crime. A lot of the root cause of crime is poverty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so if we're not connecting poverty and accessibility to resources and supports with that issue, we're not going to be able to actually solve any of it. We're just punishing people mm-hmm. for their life circumstances. And that's not the right way to do things.
Well, and in this county, we're hitting a point where we're seeing a generational pattern now of a lot of the same scenarios. And that's where I would argue there's not necessarily the easiest education around how do I access resources or what's my other alternative to what I know being in this area. And coming from Ipsy, a lot of that changed when we lost a lot of the auto industry and the factories. I mean, back in Ipsy Township when Little Run closed down, you know, poverty went through the roof. And so, like, my father growing up in Ipsy knew that area as the rich area. Now me growing up, I know it as a struggling area. So you're seeing, like, generations continuing this issue now, and we haven't addressed a lot of those root issues. And, you know, people are upset by it, but a lot of people don't even really get what caused that. They mm-hmm. just know it's kind of like a problem. But then if you sit down and say, well, this is how we got from point A to point B, C, D, they're kind of shocked.
Right.
Because there is a lot of that disconnect.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I would take this conversation at another level as well, because like I brought up the Green New Deal earlier, and that's addressing, we know why climate change is happening.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people that don't like the answer that science has given us, and so they, you know, try to obfuscate that. But the fact is that we have a clear answer with all kinds of data to back it up. There's no solid reason to think otherwise. We know why climate change happens. Mm-hmm. Why does poverty happen? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of question that we need to ask if we're going to address that, you know, at whatever level of government we're going to address it, because if we don't understand the causes, then we'll only treat them by accident. And
right.
when we treat something by accident, we're probably not treating it, you know, in the most effective way. So here's a question for you. As somebody who's been in politics as long as you described, at the beginning here, from your perspective, What are the causes of poverty, and how ought we to address those?
I'd say I don't know if there's one central cause of poverty, but in my experience, it really is generational. You have families in poverty, and those families end up in neighborhoods that have high concentrations of poverty, and then those neighborhoods don't get the voice with elected officials or the investments that they need because people don't want to invest in those areas. Or even worse, what used to happen is you'd cite, you know, waste facilities and things like that in those lower income areas.
Well, that's still a continuous problem.
Right. And so you just have this incredible concentration of things getting worse and worse, and you don't have anybody that reaches a hand out and says, let's help pull some of these kids mm-hmm. and try and pull their families out of poverty.
So I want to stick with the trying to figure out the causes, because, you know, the way that you're talking about it, there's something that happens that concentrates a lot of people that have that don't have a lot of money in particular areas, and as a result, many things happen. But the cause of it is therefore the surrounding environment of whatever it is. I mean, that's the thing that we're talking about that causes poverty, is the system that creates those concentrations. And you find that, you know, anytime you look at, you look at nature and you find out, hey, you know what, there's a concentration of this kind of chemical over here. There's some reason that chemical is being concentrated there, whether it's that you have a lot of water gathered in this lake because of the topology of the surrounding land, that, you know, water flows down into that area and creates a lake. There's some environmental issue in our society that is causing these concentrations of poverty. And so that's what I think we have to get at, is what are those systems that create that environment that drive those kinds of that drive poverty and that drive it to be concentrated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think a big part of that system, though, is we reward people for having money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you own a home, you get a tax break. If you have money that you can invest in the stock market or savings or things like that, you mm-hmm. get interest mm-hmm. and you get mm-hmm. dividends. You earn money off of that money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you don't have money, there aren't a lot of ways to get money.
Just to say what I actually just think that the way that you said that makes it pretty clear that what you're saying is that our society is designed to provide extra rent to people who already have money.
Right.
Rent to the economic sense.
If you have
sense,
money,
so.
You have this ability to get so much extra money because of investments and things. But what I'd like to touch on with that scenario is you have to have the understanding and education of how to do that in the first place.
Right.
And I've met a lot of individuals who've come from really low, like, poverty lines who weren't even familiar with, like, how do I get a bank
right.
account. And
Nor
so,
can
like,
they open them sometimes because they don't have credit.
Or they don't have the proper ID, or they don't have the proof of residence to have it at that address, or so on and so forth. So there are loopholes and lines, but I mean, something that I have learned is that there's a lot of like financial literacy. And a friend of mine, Keisha Hudson, she's an activist up in Detroit. She's actually trying to facilitate a organization or a program that focuses on teaching financial literacy in the Detroit school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that, so once again, I come from Ipsy, so I come from Ipsy Township, where our school systems struggle. It's something that I think would be interesting to see if those programs start getting implemented, if that's something you can implement here, because I do think, you know, if, let's say, someone gets a decently good-paying job from a low-income household, now they need to know, okay, what do I do with this?
Right.
Because a lot of times if you get it, suddenly you want to take care of the community you're in. And so that's very much how my friendships and my community work, is if one of us is better off, we usually make sure everyone else is okay. But then there's not a lot of knowing of how to invest it, of how to work with this, right. because we didn't grow up or in a world that necessarily showed that.
Right.
It's very paycheck to paycheck. So I think there's this education gap that I don't quite know where we fill that in yet.
Well,
but
so
I do think we
have,
to.
Thoughts on that. So, Liano, as you're talking about, so the best two paths out of poverty are a good paying job, or education.
Mm-hmm.
And the part where the county,
a good paying job leading to education. I mean, good education leading to a good paying job.
Well, it doesn't always have to be. If you can get a good paying job with their lower skilled jobs, which are very hard to find these days, you're okay for a while. Longer term, there aren't going to be very many. They're going to be even less low paid. Or
sure.
low-skilled jobs that pay decent wages.
Yeah.
But that education piece is critical.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I really want us to look at in sort of creating a vision for the county is certainly looking at universal pre-K, because we've seen that to be a not only a thing that helps families now, because the amount that people pay for daycare are working is absolutely ridiculous. Sometimes people working these jobs don't even make enough money to cover daycare.
Right.
My sister-in-law up north, my brother works. She was trying to work for a while, but she was working at the local grocery store, and it was a job that didn't pay enough after she had a second kid to cover the cost of daycare. Right. So she said, well, this doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Why am I going to work to pay all of my money to somebody else to watch my kids?
Yeah.
And so now she's staying home because they have three kids at this point. And they want those three kids. They're beautiful, wonderful children.
Sure.
But there isn't any sort of program to help her with childcare.
Right.
So universal pre-K not only helps with that aspect, but it is also proven by every metric to help people long-term, help children long-term educationally.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking at the other end of it is looking at a College Promise program for Washtenaw County. These are expensive programs in many ways, but we haven't really found any successful way to do those things yet.
Right.
But that's why I want to talk about looking at a vision to say, as a community, what is our vision for the future? Do we have a vision that says every child has the opportunity for a good education at every level up until at least 2-year college?
Mm-hmm.
And if we agree that that's our vision, then we can start working at how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But we've never even had a massive community conversation about saying that's something we want.
Right.
We have incredible resources, the nonprofits, the businesses, the the university, the county, the city of Ann Arbor. I mean, incredible resources in terms of money.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't had a clear vision countywide that says, here are these bigger things that we need to do.
So let's put money.
So let's put money towards it, because it means everything we spend money on means reallocation of money from somewhere else, or a saving somewhere, or finding some private partnership or nonprofit partnership. But we can't even have those discussions about trying to say, how do we get to those things? Because we haven't decided as a community wholeheartedly that these are things we want.
Yeah, what are those things?
Right. You have to decide what you need and what you want before you can start working there. On the same end, you talked about a Green New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a climate action plan for Washtenaw County.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had one ever as far as I'm concerned. And I've heard commissioners say in public, we will be carbon neutral by this such and such date. And we've signed on to the Paris Climate Accord. We've made all these statements saying we are fully committed to climate action.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're not.
Right.
When you actually look at what we're doing, we're not.
Okay.
So we passed the creation of an environmental council, thanks to Mr. Michelle Dietrich, who's a commissioner for a few more days here. Spent a lot of work on this, and we had many conversations over the last 2 years, and it finally came to head at the end of the year in our budget, where we created an environmental council, and we said in that resolution that we expect a proposal for getting to carbon neutral to come to us, I believe, by September of this next year.
That's great.
Because we were asking our facilities and infrastructure staff, as they were presenting to the board, we said, well, what's our plan? How are we at least even making sure that we're buying more fuel-efficient vehicles?
Mm-hmm.
Or trying not to buy more vehicles wherever we can?
Right.
And they said, well, we don't really have a plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kept pushing them on it. And they're really good people, and they're trying very hard to do their jobs well. But we kept pushing them. And I said, well, why don't we? How do we expect to get to any of these goals if we don't actually know how we can get there?
Right.
Yeah.
And they said, well, it's too expensive. We won't be able to do it. And so we finally just said at the next meeting, we created this environmental council. We said, we at least have to know. Tell us what it will take to get there so that we can then determine what we can afford to do. And quite frankly, we really can't afford to not do something, if not everything, because of that UN report that says basically we're all doomed in 12 years.
Well, it's like, you can't go back at that point. So what I often tell people is right now we're talking about how do we stop climate change, but what we're looking at now looks like in 12 years, it's no longer that word of stop. Now it's how do we cope with climate change. And what people I don't think realize is that change from stop to cope is a really big deal.
Yeah.
And that cope is going to change a lot more. How extreme is it going to get? How bad is it going to get? I just was at Congresswoman Dingell's office this past week advocating for the Green New Deal. And that was one of the things I said is, you know, they gave us a 12-year mark. Well, I have a 2-year-old nephew. In 12 years, he's going to be 14. He won't be sick. He won't have a license or anything by that time. And I'm sitting here like, we're going to have to worry now. What air is he going to be able to breathe by the time he's 24?
Yeah.
And that was kind of what I had spoken at her office. But no, like, we have to do something. And I think Washtenaw is a county that has some really unique environmental activists like County Commissioner Michelle Dietrich, and like a lot of groups, you have Clean Water Action that does a lot, and coming from Ipsy again, we were recognized for being one of the leading solar cities in the nation. We have Solar Ipsy, and you know, Ipsy Food Co-op has been really big on that, but like you said, there's not this idea of, okay, let's implement this countywide, but I do think there's a lot of really strong hubs here that could create a really, really good system to then show other counties to implement that and continue that forward.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you want to hear the final half of our conversation with Jason, sign up to help support our show on Patreon. Your monthly contribution of $5 or more will give you access to bonus content like extended episodes and exclusive one-on-one interviews with special guests. Find us at patreon.com/Michigan Progressive. State of the Revolution is a production of Michigan Progressive. Our director and editor is Benjamin Klahn. Our producers are Sam Pernick and Mara Zumberg. Our music is composed by Benjamin Klahn. I'm Liano Sharon. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with another episode soon.